Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Did you notice? Summer officially started this weekend. School's out on Thursday in New York City. It's been out for a while in a lot of other places in the area. Time to get serious about summer reading. But is that a contradiction in terms? Getting serious about summer reading? Do you tend to lighter fare when the sun is shining and the temperature is warm? Joining me to talk about summer books, among other things, including soccer, by the way, is an author with a horse in this game. Elizabeth Gilbert's latest novel, The Signature of All Things, is just out in paperback. You may know her from that book or that other one, Eat, Pray, Love. That was part book, part Opernomenon. She's provided us with a bit of her summer reading list. Share your own on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and see what we've posted there from Elizabeth Gilbert. Welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Brian, did you just invent the portmanteau Opernomenon?
One of my producers fed me that little word. You like it?
I like it. I like it. It works. Nice to see you. How are you?
Nice to see you. I'm good. And it's great to see you face to face in the studio. And you generously sent us two lists, books you want to read this summer and some past favorites.
Yeah.
And I'd say neither list contains your typical beach read, by which I mean something in the Jacqueline Suzanne school of pulpy trash. What makes a perfect summer book for you?
For me, my association with perfect summer books are big, juicy, complex, epic novels, because I feel like you need the languid, sort of sweaty hours of summer to get yourself through those great books. It's weird because the other great time to read those is, of course, in the dead of winter when it's dark at 3 p.m. But I like to enjoy summer tackling like big, nutritious books.
And so let's dive right in here.
Yeah.
And these are all novels, except one on your list of books to read this summer, which is not in that exception, is the late theater director Moss Hart's memoir, Act One.
Right. Right, which I expect probably will read like a novel because from what I know about him, his life sort of read like a novel. And that's a little bit of homework for me, too, because I'm working on a novel about New York City theater in the 1940s. And it feels like you can't even begin to approach that subject without having read Act One, which I think everybody universally agrees is the best theater memoir of all time. So that's on my list.
So let's go through a few of these.
Yeah.
Besides Act One, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
And to be fair, I'm halfway through it. When I sent you this list, I had was just beginning it, and I can't stay away from it. It is the perfect summer novel, World War II, complex, beautiful, interconnected stories of a young French girl and a young German boy.
Oh, yeah,
it's wonderful.
A blind French girl and a German boy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Occupied France.
It's really, really exquisite. And it's also, it sort of intersects in a way with my interests because it's about science and the natural world as well. So it's these lives of people who are very fascinated with natural philosophy who are caught up in war.
Another one, The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner.
Just started that as well. I tend to be always reading about seven books at the same time. I don't know if everyone else has that habit. It is. Until one hooks me, and then, I'm monogamous to it. And then I go back to my party ways of having six or seven on my bedside table.
I've done that too. I've gone on vacation with like three or four novels and read the first, even as little as 10, 15 pages of each.
Yeah.
And then, okay, which is really my read for
right.
these 2 weeks.
It's like speed dating. you have to sort of meet them all on the first pages and then see who grabs you. So I think The Flamethrowers is going to be great. I've heard, obviously it was a huge hit last year, and I've heard great things about it.
Set in the mid-70s, its narrator, a woman in her early 20s, has come to New York to turn her fascination with motorcycles into an art career, according to the blurb that I've read. I have not read this book, but that sounds like a fun 1970s confection.
Yeah, it is. Although it doesn't read like a confection. It's intense. It's about, weirdly, it's about motorcycles and avant-garde art and terrorism. And I think it's a bit of a heavy beach read, but I'm up for it.
And listeners, share your summer reading list with Elizabeth Gilbert, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9673. 9-2. And, of course, if you want to talk to her about her own books, including The Signature of All Things, just out in paperback, or Eat, Pray, Love, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Come on in. The summer Reed Waters are fine. Also on your list for this summer, Parrot and Olivier in America by Peter Carey. That's a few years old.
It is. It's a reward book for me because it's a book that I wasn't able to read over. I love Peter Carey. And there are certain books when you're writing a novel that you can't read because they're too similar to what you're working on. So for the 4 years that I spent reading The Signature of All Things, that has been sitting unwrapped by my bedside table because it is also a little bit about naturalism, about 18th and 19th century exploration in America. It was just, I knew that it would be influencing me in the wrong ways. And so now that I've put my own period novel away, I'm allowed to dive into
it's like
Peter Carey.
It's like fictionalized de Tocqueville, isn't it?
Yeah. Of course. What else would you want to read for the summer? And I know that
it's a fascinating, again, it's another one I haven't read, but it's a fascinating premise.
I will read anything that Peter Carey writes, one, and two, it is a fascinating premise. And the secondary character, the one who's not based on de Tocqueville, is an engraver of naturalist prints, which is similar to a character in my novel. Again, why I couldn't read it before and why I'm allowed to now.
But why would that have gotten in the way of writing Signature? Why wouldn't you want to be consuming, you know, lots of input about that period if that's what you were immersing yourself in?
I did want to, and I did end up doing that. It's more important for me to read books from that period than books about that period, and particularly so with novels, because you don't want to even accidentally, I mean, you certainly don't want to intentionally plagiarize, but you don't want to accidentally plagiarize, and you also don't want to fall off your game, especially with a master like Peter Carey, where you just, you know, a few chapters in, you're likely to think, why am I even trying to play in this playing field that others have done so well? So I think it's better to just avoid it.
I could see where it would potentially affect your writing process. And this happens in journalism, too, in nonfiction, where you think you're onto a great idea, you're pursuing it, it's your idea, it's original, you're into it, and then you discover there's something similar going on, and you get off your inner voice.
Yeah.
Because you just don't want to be competing with somebody, or you don't want to be on the same track that somebody else who you might respect is on.
And so
it throws you off yourself.
It does. And ideas are very disloyal. just because you love your idea doesn't mean that it's necessarily loyal to you. And so I do think you have to be careful to stay away from other people who are on the same track.
And you're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York, and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer, along with Elizabeth Gilbert. And let's take a phone call. Sherry in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Is this for Carrie?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Gilbert's fiction in particular, and I think that summertime is a time for rereading, too. So I'd like to recommend her first novel, Stern Men, which is a very, to use the cliche, wise and witty, but there's a reason it's a cliche. It's a wise and witty first a novel set off the coast of Maine with a doughty young heroine and, of course, not a few lobsters. And going back to the last century, I'm going to reread her first book of short stories, Pilgrims. So I recommend them to everyone, and especially to those who've stuck with her nonfiction.
Are you her publicist?
Or my mom?
No. We've never met. I've never spoken to her, but I've spoken of her.
That's so sweet. So if you're such a fan, do you want to ask Elizabeth anything?
Well, actually, I'd just like to sort of stick with her books.
Aww.
I'm looking forward
you.
To what else she has to say over the course of this conversation, of course, but it's time for me to cede to the next caller.
Thank you very
much. What a completely and thoroughly wonderful person. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So now I have to find somebody who's going to beat you up.
that will not be hard, Brian.
I don't think that will be easy. Sherry in Dobbs Ferry, you're on WNYC. Hello.
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 Hi, I have downloaded the entire George R. R. Martin saga into my Kindle, all five books. And it's just amazing. Just chewy stuff. It's all the things that the Game of Thrones is based on.
Saga of Fire and Ice.
Yes.
And did your Kindle explode? Isn't that about cumulatively a 500,000 pages?
almost. My partner and some friends of varied ages and backgrounds loved it, and I got tired of fighting it. So,
don't fight it. No, I haven't read them myself, only because I don't want to. This is so backwards, but I don't want any spoilers for the show that I am completely obsessed with, Game of Thrones.
I haven't seen the show.
Oh.
I refuse to watch it, and I duck and dodge TV headlines and newspapers and
Why do you refuse to watch it? If you're into George R. R. Martin.
In my experience, books that I like and books that I love that have been made for the most part into movies or TV series usually disappoint me.
Thank you very much.
And you haven't seen the dragons yet, though.
And I take it you haven't seen the finale of the season yet of Game of Thrones.
I most certainly have.
Oh, I thought you were worried about
a
spoiler.
No, I don't read the books because I don't want to spoil this television show, which makes me sound like the most unliterary person in the entire world. Only because I started
with
the show.
That's very sophisticated.
I think it's kind of the opposite of sophisticated.
Well, it's sophisticated gamesmanship.
Yeah, it is. But I'm so terrified to find out who dies that I have to stay away from the books till the show's over, which will be 20 years from now.
A listener wrote in to suggest a book called We Were Liars by E. Lockhart. She's saving it for a trip to Mexico. It's a book about a family at their summer house, and it's also a young adult novel. Is summertime a good time to regress a little and catch up on, you know, I don't even know if I can call young adult novels regression anymore because they tend to be so dystopian, like The Hunger Games.
Yeah, they're not exactly escapist, except for that the people are usually escaping some horrible, grisly, bloody death in those novels. But I will say that it is a time. There are certain novels that you read in certain summers of your life that I think will always stay with you. And so there'll be a sort of a novel of each summer. And a couple years ago, I read a book called The Summer Book, which has the perfect title for summer reading, by Tove Jansson, who wrote the Moomin children's books. It's a sort of thinly disguised fictional memoirish book about a young girl, 6-year-old girl, on a small idyllic island in the Gulf of Finland, translated from Swedish. It is the most exquisite, nostalgic, perfect. You can almost feel the northern light of summer in Scandinavia. It is such a perfect book.
Called The Summer Book.
The Summer Book. In case they haven't pointed out clearly enough what a perfect summer book it is.
What the marketing trick was in the title of the name. That's like from the early 70s, right?
Yeah, that's a classic. It's beautiful.
So the travel in that listener's suggestion that she's saving it for a trip to Mexico, the We Were Liars. Are there books that you save for travel, books, say, with a plucky heroine who travels off to far lands, like maybe The Signature of All Things?
Well, that, of course, would be a lovely book to save for travel and is about travel. You want a big, juicy, long airplane novel, I think. And my greatest fear, okay, I have bigger fears than this existentially, but literarily my greatest fear has been to be trapped without a big book when traveling, which is why I've embraced reading online and reading electronically, even though it's a purist.
What's your device of choice?
I read on my iPad, yeah.
I like the iPad. It's bigger than the Kindle.
Well, I used to travel. I mean, I remember going to visit my husband when he was living in Indonesia. I went for 2 months and I brought one carry-on with my clothes and a giant suitcase full of books because of the fear of being stranded with nothing to read. That's a true terror for me. So the Kindle and the iPad have saved that.
So this conflicts with the purist streak in you?
Whatever is left or ever existed in a purist streak. Yeah, definitely.
And travel is such an integral part of Eat, Pray, Love, too, especially your trip to India. Do you see a difference between travel and tourism?
You know, I'm going to not be a purist here. Purist is, of course, a polite word for a snob, and I think I sometimes get offended by people drawing that line and very archly saying I'm not a tourist, I'm a traveler. I feel like it's there's an arrogance in it, because nobody can say what somebody is getting out of a voyage. And I know, for instance, that my mother, who travels every year with her sister-in-law, and they go away for 2 weeks and they have these great adventures. And by any definition, they're tourists, but they're women in their 70s who waited their whole lives to travel. This is the allotted time that they have. They've been to Turkey, to Costa Rica, to Peru. They've done these really wonderful, adventurous things. And I feel like defending their honor and saying, you know, they've got lives that they have to hold up their contracts to, and this is their moment to see what they can of the world in the time that they've got.
That's very nice. That's very sweet, actually. But I think that travel has played a deeper role for you in your life than that, at least as reflected by your writing. What would you say about travel and the role that it has played in your inner life as well as your exploration of the world?
I kind of don't know who or what I would be without it. The first trip I ever took in my life was when I was 16 years old. I went to the Soviet Union with money that I had saved from years of babysitting. I went for 10 days on a peace exchange trip with Russian students. It was in the beginning of Gorbachev's reign, and there was this sort of crack, you know, where you could get in. And I was eager to be one of the first people in. And I was a junior in high school in a small town in Connecticut. But I really wanted to be as far away as I could and in the most interesting places that I could be in. I remember somebody telling me once when I was in my 20s, it's a good thing you're doing this now because you won't have the chance to do it when you're older. And I remember thinking, that makes sense. I understand your logic. However, I actually think I will always be doing this, and it's the case that I remain a traveler.
And so has your relationship with travel changed since then? Does it play a different role, again, in your inner life as well as your curiosity about the world? Since you've left your 20s?
No. to be perfectly honest, I don't think it's changed since I was 16 and went to the Soviet Union for the first time. There's somebody asked me in an interview the other day the strangest question, what's your favorite sound? And I said the hum of a transcontinental or transatlantic airplane in the middle of the night. I don't think there's anything more soothing to me. It's this wonderful sense that no one can reach you, that you're on your way to something unexpected and unknown. And I've never gotten over my adolescent excitement about it.
We are comparing notes on summer reading lists and travel and other things with Elizabeth Gilbert, whose book, The Signature of All Things, is just out in paperback, and who is, of course, also the author of Eat, Pray, Love, among other books. For your curiosity, before we get back to the phones, there are, a couple of events. Elizabeth Gilbert will be in conversation with Rebecca Mead tonight at St. Joseph's College on Clinton between DeKalb and Willoughby in Brooklyn at 7:30 tonight at St. Joseph's College. And tomorrow night, Ridgewood Public Library, that's Ridgewood, New Jersey, not Ridgewood, Queens. Don't go there. The Signature of All Things is out in paperback today, and I guess that's why you're doing some public appearances at this particular moment, right?
Yeah, of course.
And Abby in Plainview, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I highly recommend Reed Farrell Coleman's The Hollow Girl. It's the last in his Mo Prager detective series, but you don't have to have read all the other books to enjoy it. His stories are beautifully layered. The characters, every character is fleshed out and sympathetic and intelligent. He lives here on Long Island, actually, and his stories are woven with Coney Island and Brooklyn and Long Island. And it's just a wonderful read because it's not only a great mystery story, it's got fabulous humor in it as well.
Thank you very much. Here's another recommendation of a book with summer in the title from Tony in Manhattan. Tony, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, hi. How are you? I'm calling to recommend actually a book that I read a rave on NPR about on the NPR website a while ago called The Summer Prince by Alaya Dawn Johnson. And Alaya is A-L-A-Y-A. And it's really a beautiful book, and it's set in a future post-apocalyptic Brazil. And it's loaded with just fascinating kind of art things and political things. And I'm not sure, is your guest familiar with Elia's work? This is her fifth or sixth book.
I'm not, and I'm actually going to ask you if this Summer Prince, is that prince like the heir to the throne or prince like a lithograph? Is it P-R-I?
Like Heir to the Throne.
Oh, okay. Okay,
prince.
Cool.
The summer prince.
It turns every 5 years, there's a summer prince is chosen and then sacrificed. And anyway, the imagery in the book is just beautiful, and it really just brings you into a completely other world. And
cool.
And I'm only halfway through it now, I have to say, but I love it.
Thank you. You have roused our guest curiosity.
I just wrote it down. I'll read anything about Brazil.
Yeah.
Even post-apocalyptic Brazil.
Elia John Johnson.
Thank you so much.
Tony, thank you very much. Let's see. Post-apocalyptic Brazil. Would that be Brazil after the U.S. beats them in the World Cup? Looks like you could go into sports commentary, Elizabeth Gilbert, because at Gilbert Liz is pretty much live tweeting the games from what we've seen.
I know. I was saying this morning to a friend, I think I'm losing my spiritual seeking Twitter follow because all I'm doing is live tweeting World Cup games pretty much around the clock. I'm hoarse from cheering on. How about that Portugal-U.S. game the other day?
Kick in the gut.
I feel like I haven't even picked my jaw up from that. That was devastating.
And yet if it went any other way and the outcome was the same, a draw.
Yeah.
People would have been like, yeah.
Well, I still feel like I think part of the joy of watching this World Cup is that this is, I think, quite literally the only instance in the world in which the United States is a scrappy little underdog. And there's something really fun about being able to, unabashedly cheer on the United States without sounding sort of fascistic.
I love that take on it.
So it's really fun to be like, oh, those are our kids, our boys, you know. It's lovely.
Also, did you see the ratings that came out yesterday for that game? 25 million homes or viewers, I forget what exactly they measure, but it was compared to 15 million for each game of the World Series last year.
What?
So soccer has arrived.
Hello, America's pastime.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
At least once every 4 years.
Oh, that's so great. No, I've been having a tremendous amount of fun tweeting the games. It's been great.
Rita in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to know, about Guru Mai and how she influenced you, how you met her, because you have, mentioned her. So I was just curious.
This is a reference to the particular guru who's the spiritual head of the ashram that I went to in India.
Yes.
I have never actually met her in person. I've only studied at her ashram when she was not in residence. But of course, I feel a great closeness to her and to her wisdom.
And what do you do when you're at the ashram?
You meditate most of the waking hours of the day, those waking hours beginning at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And you that's really about it. It's intense. It's sort of boot camp for self, for introspection. It's not a spa. It's not a relaxing experience, but it's a pivotal one.
How do you get confronted in meditation?
Well, if you're like me, and you probably are because you're a human being, your mind is probably a very bad neighborhood that you wouldn't want to walk around in alone at night. And most of us spend our lives trying to dodge that neighborhood. And the difference between regular living and meditative thinking is that you're actually looking at that bravely and courageously and consistently. And it's shocking.
But, I think that's different than the impression that a lot of people have of meditation, which is that you get taught to push thoughts away and try to empty the mind and not have it be about the content of your life or the content of your thoughts while you're meditating. Do you do a different kind of meditation than that?
No, I do that. I aim for that. But I don't have much luck emptying my mind. And what I've learned over the years in my meditation practice is that I do better watching it in a detached way than emptying it. I've never had this sort of perfectly scrubbed, clean Zen mind that we all aspire to. But I have learned how to not get involved with the drama of my own thinking. And that's more what my meditation is. It's like a subway train that arrives at a station, you don't get on it.
And then do you find that after you've done a retreat like that, that you can apply whatever insights or emotions you've had or spiritual cleansing, however you want to describe it, to your day-to-day life, to real relationships in the real world? Is it relevant enough to that to sit and meditate at an ashram?
I think if it isn't, then it's not worth the time or investment, because my feeling is that any spiritual practice that doesn't actually make the difficulties of your daily life easier and your relationships more manageable is worthless. You don't just do it, for because it looks good, right? Like, you do it because you're trying to find strategies and tactics for managing the complexity of being a human being. So it does seem to help. You know, I'm far from a master, but I'm better off than I used to be.
Lisa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share with Elizabeth that I read your book, Eat, Pray, Love, and it just had such an impact on me. I was in a bad marriage, 26-year bad marriage, and I read it and took a trip to Italy with this man and just took the book with me just to help jar my memory of all the Italian scenery and imagery that you had so beautifully described. And while I read it, while I was there and had some downtime and some real contemplative time with him, I just realized I had to leave him. And
oh my
goodness. It was when I got back, I moved out, and it was such a pivotal tool for me in examining a relationship that really was very damaging. And I just wanted to thank you. It was really a pivotal time in my life.
Wow.
And a pivotal tool.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry. I mean, I know that was not an easy thing for you to have gone through, and I'm happy you've come out safely on the other side.
It's a good thing. It's a really good thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lisa, thanks. What's it like to have that kind of influence on people's, you know, the most intimate part of people's lives after you kind of sat in your room and wrote words on a page?
It's very touching, and it doesn't stop being touching for me. You know, it's been almost 10 years now since Eat, Pray, Love came out, and it's not like I ever get to a point where I'm jaded to a response like that. I think especially because of how surprising it is to discover again and again that there are so many women in particular who really never did get the memo that their lives belong to themselves. And I think it's so easy for women who are good at being good to live in imitation of somebody else's life better than, you know, the messy, awkward reality of their own. And if my book did nothing else than give people permission to embark on their own journeys, whatever that might be, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that everybody has to get divorced and move to India, but there does come a point where you have your own reckoning, and I'm happy that the book empowered people to have those reckonings.
And I see you're going on tour with Oprah this fall, along with some of her other regulars.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing you'll be focusing on?
Yeah, completely. And what I like about, I mean, well, first of all, what I like about going on tour with Oprah is that Oprah wants me to go on tour with her, which is amazing. But what I love about this particular venue, this possibility of this 8-city tour, is that I can be so unabashedly and unironically talking about what I really care about, you know, and what I really, really care about are women's journeys and women's lives and letting people find the treasures that are hidden within them and giving them the permission slip from the principal's office that they somehow never got, that they are allowed to ask these questions and go on these journeys.
Before you go, can I pluck you on an issue? You mentioned reading on your devices.
Yeah.
Do you have a take on the Hachette versus Amazon standoff and the implications for writing?
Too soon to tell. To quote, who was the Chinese premier who said that when they asked him what he thought the effect of the French Revolution was on world history in the 1950s? He said, too soon to tell. I feel that way about everything that's happening in the book and publishing world right now. It's anybody who claims to have a hook on this and to understand exactly what's going or where we're going to be in 10 years, much less 20 or even next month, is just reading tea leaves because I don't think anybody has the first idea what's going on.
But your relationship with your publisher doesn't suggest that if Amazon becomes the publisher and eliminates the publishing industry as kind of the middleman, that isn't going to be to the detriment of literature?
The detriment of literature is a song that people have been singing for centuries. And I have trouble jumping on board that every time there's a new catastrophe. We are still here. And it's not like before the internet and before Amazon back in 1987, when I was telling people that I wanted to be a writer, they were like, well, that's a great, safe business career to go into because that's on the up and up. You know, it's never been on the up and up. It's only ever been on the down and down. And yet, we tell stories. People want our stories. I want to read. I want to write. So do you. We're still here. Too soon to bang the gong yet.
All right. Let's finish up with a tweet that we just got from writer Rosie Schapp, who tweets, at Gilbert Liz, said on at Brian Lehrer, she thinks she may have lost followers because of her World Cup tweeting. She's gained at least one new one.
Oh, that's lovely. See you this afternoon.
That's right. And Thursday afternoon, and at noon. You're tweeting the other countries' games, too?
I'm tweeting all the games.
Really?
I'm equally interested in all of them. The problem is I'm going on book tour, so I just need to call FIFA and ask them if they can just postpone for a week. Yeah, just for a week. I don't think it'll be a problem.
Did you get into soccer so much because you've traveled the world so much?
Well, one of my greatest experiences when I was living in Italy was going to soccer games with my friend Luca, and I actually write about it in Eat, Pray, Love, including a long transcript of all the curses that I learned in soccer games. And then, of course, I'm married to a Brazilian, so it's not like he's doing anything else for the next 2 weeks.
And there we leave it. We have information on our webpage about getting tickets to Elizabeth Gilbert's conversation with Rebecca Mead tonight at St. Joseph's College on Clinton between DeKalb and Willoughby in Brooklyn at 7:30, and tomorrow night's event at the Ridgewood Public Library in Ridgewood, New Jersey. The Signature of All Things is out in paperback today, and this has been such a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Oh, by the way, we also have the summer reading list that Elizabeth Gilbert provided us. Two, really, ones that she wants to read this summer and some of her favorites from past summers also on our page. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show.